This message comes from BetterHelp. Can you think of a time when you didn't feel like you could be yourself? Like you were hiding behind a mask? BetterHelp Online Therapy is convenient, flexible, and can help you learn to be your authentic self so you can stop hiding. Because masks should be for Halloween fun, not for your emotions. Take off the mask with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to The Stack. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
And in The Stack, we talk about a ton of books that are coming out this week. We review them just for you.
Only we view them, and when we review them, and that's when we talk. We don't talk the first time, we just read them quietly in our worlds.
Oh my God, I thought when we review them, we look at them again and we don't say anything.
You've been noticeably quiet.
Oh, this is going to be tough now that Pete isn't here this week, because I guess I'm going to have to talk about stuff.
Let's see if I have
anything to say about our first book here, Absolute Batman, number one from DC Comics, written by Scott Snyder, art by Nick Dragotta. We got a little bit of a tease of the new Absolute Universe last week in the DC All-In Special, but this is the official kickoff. We're getting to see the big boy Batman himself in action. This is a completely new take on Batman, completely new take on Gotham City and everybody inherent there. And over the course of the issue, we don't only get a new origin for Bruce Wayne, we also see a completely revamped different Alfred Pennyworth, a different Black Mask, and a bunch of other things. I want to hear from you first, Justin.
Oh, because, Alex, I
wanted to view before I review. No, okay. I mean, I could go effusive about this, but I got a sense that you were a little reserved about it when we were talking about it on the live show. So I'm curious to hear from you.
No, I'm not at all. I mean, the Nick Dragotta art, there's been much made of this cover image that you're seeing right here, as if you're watching us on YouTube. About how this is that thick Batman. Like, give me that slab. Give me that bat meat. I want to eat that Batman. You know, that's the
people. Is that what people are saying? Or that's
That's a discourse.
That's your Threads account is most of that.
Yes, exactly.
Right?
That's the only thing I've ever posted on Threads. That should be fine. But everyone wants to take a knife and fork to these bat hammies on our Bruce Wayne here. But I think the Nick Dragotta art in this book is fantastic. So I want to start there. Love Nick Dragotta. Great to see him on this big title. And then as far as the story, I do like it. I think it's great. I can't believe Pete's not here to see Alfred meets the Punisher, meets like reticent Punisher as the character who is like, I really want to intervene. And then he's like, you can. He's like, okay, I'll just make a sandwich for myself on this rooftop. But I think this is fun. It's so Scott Snyder. It feels like Scott Snyder is being his peak self here. He's bringing all of his, gathering all of his energy from his run way back in the day on Detective Comics, which was dark, moody. All of his DC, the Dark Metal universe and all of that, collecting that here. And then just his run on the Batman title, where he really was sort of reinventing, putting Commissioner Gordon in the Batsuit for a while, inventing new villains. It feels like this is the sort of tip of the spear of a lot of his work in this world.
I think that's a really good way of thinking about it, but to take it one step further without being quite so nihilistic, this does feel like very much an extension of the Dark Multiverse work, because this is a darker, more chaotic universe infused with dark side energy. And what you're getting here is it's a more violent Batman. He is big like that because he doesn't have to hide himself, is the whole idea that he could be like, yeah, I'm basically Batman all the time. It's fine. I work in the sewers.
Well, his other job is construction work. So he's like, I'm swole there too. I can be big there.
I love this though. Like, I think more than any of those things, though, what Scott is doing here is leaning into Nick Dragotta on art and letting him go absolutely wild in the way that only he can. Some of the images here are just absolutely stunning. Like, first of all, just to take a slight step back, the big boy Batman, I think, is all because of Nick Dragotta's anime-inspired, anime manga-inspired style. Like, that's what this feels like. is a blending between manga style Batman and American style Batman, and kind of finding like a midway point there. There's big gothic tall buildings. He's got those bat wings that he can kind of like walk on and hit people with. And there's, to spoil one of the coolest moments of the book, but they've already put it all over social media, where everybody is wondering, like, what is up with that weird bat symbol? He turns it into an axe. That's awesome.
Sick. Like, everything's so functional, and you get the, also, like, it has year one energy also. Like, it's a younger Bruce Wayne. It's a, like, edgier Bruce Wayne. It's someone who you feel like can make mistakes, but is also a badass. Like, it's so many of the Bat books are about him being too proficient, extremely proficient to too proficient, that he makes his own mistakes. Or he's a little young and not quite, like, he's not locked down. He doesn't have, he's a little reckless. This combines those to just be extreme. Like, he might as well have, like, a sick electric guitar come out of that bat symbol, because that's what it feels like is happening.
Yeah, and the Alfred is great. I won't spoil what happens at the end, but I'm really intrigued. I think this is a great kickoff to the Absolute line. One that I think, like a lot of people, even though I like the creators involved, I was a little hesitant about, because it felt like, oh yeah, we're also doing our Ultimate Universe. That's not what this feels like. This feels not like something different. It feels, honestly, if anything, closer to what the All-Star line should have been and never really was. Though, obviously, we do have the ties to DC continuity, but they're not going to be coming back to that for a while.
Well, and here's the only thing I have questions about is the dark side infused universe of it. The fact that we started in that as a continuity thing, I'm like, wait, what? Because this book has nothing to do with that. And, like, that's fine. Because what this feels like to me more so is a black label universe, like, where the characters can interact as opposed to standalone stories. That feels more true to what this is.
So this is total, like, 4D chess type thing. But just to lay in a little bit of information here, we've got Absolute Batman. In 2 weeks, we're going to get Absolute Wonder Woman. 2 weeks after that, we're getting Absolute Superman. They're working on a couple of other things. We know Jeff Lemire is doing Absolute Flash. I'm blanking on, I want to say it's Ram V, is doing Absolute Green Lantern, but we don't really know much about those. So we're going to get more stuff down the road. As far as they've explained it, and as far as, like, Scott explained it to me, is they're trying to let everything stand on its own for at least a year, if not 2 years. Like, they want to be, like, 2 years
gone. I don't want more.
The 4D chess part is, I think, by tying it to the main DC continuity, they get around the idea of fans being like, oh, well, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because it's not in continuity, because it is. It isn't going to affect the first, let's say, 2 years of storytelling while they slowly establish the characters of this new universe. But the other thing that's going to do really smartly is when they reach the end of that 2 years, there is no way, and I say this from reading comics my entire life, that they're not going to reach critical mass in terms of, like, everybody knowing each other and the storyline starting to speed up. Like, that's going to reach the natural end point of a lot of these storylines, and probably they can keep them going past there, but that's the point when you jam these two universes back together, come back to this big mega Uber story that it seems like they're following a lot more closely in the mainline DC universe. And I think just based on these first couple of issues, I think that's really smartly done.
Yeah, and I'd be curious, because if the rest of the titles, and I love all the creative teams, are as good as this one, I don't want them to have it interact too much. I want it to be its own thing because it's really exciting. And if this thick, chonky Batman meets our regular Twiggy Batman, like, I don't know, he's just going to tear him into tiny pieces.
Yeah, why unless, does of course, the larger Batman not eat all of the smaller Batman?
That's exactly right. What a great meal. Unless, of course, in main continuity, Batman is wearing the Nightwing costume, then he gets to be thick Nightwing.
Oh, yeah.
As we
There's
saw.
So many options. They got a lot of options on the table. Why don't we move on talking
about
our
second wardrobe. It's all about wardrobe, guys.
Speaking of wardrobe, these folks are wearing cyborg armor in Sentinels number one from Marvel, written by Alex Pachtadal, art by Justin Mason. This is a Bring on the Bad Guys title. We get a new team of cyborg Sentinels who are sent on missions to take down dangerous mutants. They're working out of Gray Malkin Prison, which is the revamped Westchester school. The thing that they don't play very heavily in this first issue, but I thought was one of the more intriguing aspects here, is all of these characters survived previous Marvel events. We get that a little bit. I think one of them is like, yeah, she got bitten in half during the whole Null thing that happened with the King in Black. And that's with all of them. And I was surprised that there wasn't more of a, like, we've got a bone to pick with the superheroes played up here, because that's not what this first issue is going for necessarily at all.
Well, and this first issue throws a lot on the table. The idea of, like, survivors of four other Marvel incidences thrown into the X universe with Sentinel armor that is somehow killing them in a way, working for people that seem like bad guys, but also seem like they still are trying to have an altruistic mission of bridging the gap so that the humans and mutants don't kill each other. Like, there's so many things on the table. They're all interesting and exciting, and the characters are really good, I thought. And I will say the art, I was like, oh, interesting choice. But then I was like, you know what this sense memories me back to? Is the Reavers from like Claremont era. The art style is very much in that vein, and the content of the book is very like Reavers adjacent. So it has like a sort of like lizard brain root in X-Men history at the same time.
Yeah. Like you're saying, I think there's a lot of intriguing ideas set up here. I'm not quite sure it totally gels into a whole at this point because there are so many things thrown on the table. I mean, we didn't even mention, like, Larry Trask is the guy in charge of this. And he's like, oh, by the way, I'm Larry Trask. I'm not Bolivar Trask. I'm the son of Bolivar Trask, who's a mutant. I died, and then Professor Xavier brought me back in an egg and gave me my mutant powers. It was like, you have a chance to be good. But instead, I'm going to be doing this other thing. And here are five of my plans that are going on. And it's like, that's a lot. This is a lot. I'm very impressed you got this all in this issue, and it gets it all across, but it's a lot to hold on to. And I think a lot of the proof is going to be in the second issue here in terms of we have one main Sentinel who seems like our good guy Sentinel who has an emotional tie to his family. I'm curious to see as we follow that, whether that's going to be a detriment for him or his strength, where we're necessarily going with this.
I think it'll be a strength, and I think I like the characters in this enough that I think they will be our sort of guiding light through all of the continuity that's on the table here. But it is funny, the Larry Trask character is like, I can still feel the yolk from the egg that I came out of. And it's just like, whoa, he's saying this. I feel weird hearing it. Imagine the people in the boardroom who he's talking to are feeling
it. Last time I was in a business meeting, another guy said the same thing, though. He was talking about a regular egg, though, that he stuck his hand in. And I was like,
true. Talk to me about this business meeting you were in. I'm so curious what you mean. Because it sounds like you're making it up. I don't know if you've been.
I don't have time. We got to move on to our next
one. Sounds like you're doing business.
The Toxic Avenger, number one from Ahoy Comics, written by Matt Boers, art by Fred Harper. This is a continuation, reinvention, to be honest, I don't really know, but of the classic Trauma.
I would call it a reboot.
Yeah, of the classic Trauma property, we're getting the origin of the Toxic Avenger. It's told in a really fascinating format where it starts us in the middle and then also goes back in time. Beyond anything else, I like the jokes in here, but I was really intrigued by the structure.
Yes, I was going to say, I feel like I'm going to bring this up a couple times in the stack. Maybe I'm in like structure brain, but I feel like so many storytelling choices in this week's stack are really smart and different. And this one sort of it starts us with sort of the fun Toxie at full Toxie form in living in Tromaville and it being like a fucked up place and him like having fun while also needing to like step up and be a hero. And then we back into his origin in a way that I really was pleasantly surprised about. And I want to shout out also the Justin Mason art and just character design I thought was really Harper? Smart. Fred Harper. I was talking. Okay. Yeah, I had the wrong name up. The Fred Harper art and character design here is so cool and really keeps your eye engaged the whole time.
Yeah. This is great. Even if you don't know anything about it, it's satirical. It's a kid who gets hit with toxic waste and gains super strength and superpowers. very fun, neat book, as usual, from Ahoy. The Terminator, number one, from Dynamite, written by Declan Shalvey and Sal Crivelli, art by Luke Sparrow and Colin Quaker. We actually talked to Sal about this a couple of shows back. He does the backup story, which we get two pages of here, but the main story is by Declan Shalvey, where a new Terminator, a T-800, I believe, is chasing down an old couple, and we get to kind of find out why, but not exactly. There's some mysteries being laid out here. I thought this was a killer first issue, honestly, and Luke Sparrow is, I was initially bummed. I was like, oh, I thought Declan was doing the art here too, but Luke Sparrow is like a Declan clone, or like almost in the same sort of style and pacing as
like
Declan.
like another T. If Declan's a T-800, he's like
exactly. No, I thought it was a really nice compliment, because I was like, Declan Shalvey obviously flexing his muscles as a writer a lot more often now, but this felt very complimentary in terms of the style on art. Great story, very tense.
Another story where I thought the format was really innovative and really worked to the advantage. It started in like a very placid place, moved us into disaster, then jumped back to disaster and caught that disaster up to the current disaster, which the fact that the story itself, the way the story was told, mirrored the time displacement that is all Terminator stories, I thought was really cool, and it felt so intentional. Especially about a story that, you know, I don't know whose side you're on when you read a Terminator comic. Usually not the machines. But I won't say anything more to spoil what happens here. But I was like, oh, okay.
really strong.
But in a good way. Like, it makes me want to read more and find out what – if this is if this is opening a door to a larger narrative or universe here, I'm very curious where it's going to go.
Yeah, I thought both the front story and the backup story, I mean, like Sal was saying on the show, it's two pages of a longer story, so it's a little harder to judge it on that, but fun start to that story as well. So really good package overall. Next up, Green Lantern Civil Corps Special, number one from DC Comics, written by Philip Kennedy Johnson and Jeremy Adams, art by Salvador LaRocca. Let's bring together Jeremy Adams' run on Green Lantern with Philip Kennedy Johnson's run on Green Lantern War Journal. So the funniest part of the issue to me was towards the beginning when all the Green Lanterns get together, like, oh, what have you been up to? What have you been doing? Oh, what's
just
your deal?
You
and then
together.
Guy Gardner's, they're like, where were you? And he's like, ah, I was in the middle of that Lobo Brainiac thing they were doing. Don't worry about it too much.
Yeah.
And then Starfire,
they were literally
Fire's
like shitting on continuity.
Yeah.
Like,
and Starfire's like, I'm also here.
Yeah.
Hooray. So that was a very funny, like, a couple of pages intro dub, but otherwise, great issue. I love both of these series, and it was fun seeing all of this stuff start to come together.
Well, and they're doing such a good job of smashing it together effectively. Like, we get to see Jadestone, the Amazo from the recent Absolute Power crossover, that I thought was really cool and interesting, and that now Jadestone gets to be a part of this comic, which is great. And I've also been saying that I'm just loving the way that Jeremy Adams and Philip Kennedy Johnson have brought really depth from Philip Kennedy Johnson's side, a lot of depth to the John Stewart character in his run. And Jeremy Adams sort of brought Hal Jordan back to a more interesting place where he is more of the reckless original Hal rather than sort of the very like by the book Barry Allen style Hal that I think has been in DC Comics for so long. So this is to see it all coming together like this feels so intentional, but I'm like, there's no way they planned this. and it's working though. And the fact that they're all pushing back against every other part of the Green Lantern mythos is coming to crush them.
Yeah.
And it's great to have this team doing that.
I will say there is one thing, though, that I will mention that has nothing really necessarily to do with this issue, but it pops up here, and I think it also pops up in the backup story in Action Comics as well. There's that whole, they quarantined Earth because they keep screwing everything up. That is, in my mind, not panned out as a story point very well, because every time, the only time it becomes important is when one of the heroes is like, But they quarantined Earth, and they're like, yeah, don't worry about it. I have a way to get past it this time. Yeah. And they always do. Well, they were like, doesn't matter.
Yeah, our rings don't work. And they're like, oh, wait, we do. They do. We found a power battery on Earth. It's like, oh, sick.
Yeah.
You should have known about it.
It's a bummer because I feel like there was more potentially to do there, but whatever the plan was or the idea, it just didn't – it fizzled out.
But I think the inherent part of that idea was like, nope, they shut down all the Green Lanterns. It's like you're like, go to a party and you're like, my phone died. And you're like, but wait, there's a charger here. Like if you need them to have juice.
I know. Anyway. All right. Next up, Blade Red Band, number one for Marvel, written by Brian Hill, art by C.F. Villa. This is spinning off of the end of Blood Hunt, where Blade was taken over by a original vampire named Varney, the big purple vampire. And now he's off on his own, doesn't want to hang out with any of the other heroes. But wouldn't you know it, a bunch of sightless magic monks decide to recruit him to go on a mission, and it goes poorly. As a Red Band title, this is adults only, and it is bloody and violent. And that is actually, I will throw out my one quibble, I thought it could have been worse.
You wanted it to be bloodier and more
violent. I wanted it to be bloodier. This felt like
this Red Band's fucking you up, man. It really is. Like, I want more. You expect it to be more extreme than it is.
It is. I mean, here's the thing. We read a lot of stuff, right? And I understand this is Marvel Comics and whatever. But we read a lot of stuff, and we see a lot of extreme stuff happening in comics elsewhere. So when they're promising me, they're like, this is going to be the most extreme, fucked up Marvel comic you've ever read in your life. And the cover is more fucked up than maybe anything that happens inside the entire issue. That's a little bit of a bummer.
Let me just lay this out to you, Alex. Like, I don't know. I guess.
Can I just say one other thing? It's like when you go to the gazillion bubble show and they only have like a couple of thousand bubbles max.
Right. Well, that's the thing is like, I'm like Red Band, like we see so much, to your point, like, we're inundated with extremity. Like, how are you like, oh, you think this is extreme? I just saw a squirrel die or something. Like, I don't know. Find your extremity in your own life, Alex.
I guess, but don't call it a Red Band then. Don't label it like that.
Well, but I think to them it's a Red Band. Look at this cover. It's got a face sliced in half. That's Red Band to them.
But that's the cover. Don't judge a book by a cover. Anyway, what did you think about this?
I just think, like, there's a lot of people who are like, yo, you want to see something cool? And I'm like, yeah, sure. And they're like, here's this thing. And I'm like, that's not cool, but you think it's cool. So, fine. I think this is good, though. Blade had to be sort of the heel of the Blood Hunt in a way that felt very cool in the very beginning and then not cool for the rest of it. Mm-hmm. The Varney taking over Blade ended up being sort of a bummer, I thought. But this is cool. This reminds me of like the original Blade movies much more than Blade in the comics. So if you're a fan of those and want to sort of get back into comics, this is a good comic to pick up.
There you go. All right. Seance in the Asylum, number one from Dark Horse Comics, written by Clay McLeod Chapman, art by Leonardo Marcello Grassi. Per the title, this is about a medium, blanked on the word there for a second, who goes to an insane asylum and is trying to set up a seance there in order to summon the madness out of people, which I thought was such a neat concept.
Great strategy.
For a book. Great strategy. Well, probably not going to work.
And this comic set in the time when they were like, that's a good idea. That's a good medical idea.
Yeah, take that guy out of leeches and bring him directly to this seance.
Yeah, and if I'm a medium, I'm like, you know where I do a seance? Where even the humans are fucked up. So the ghosts have got to be worse. and that's literally what happens in this comic in a fun way. It's also set in a time when like small towns just had asylums. Mm-hmm. And it had me thinking reading this. I was like, how many people who lose their minds in a small town of like 1,000 people, 800 people are they like, you know what? We should build a separate house just for all the people who have gone crazy.
At that time, with no phones or internet, probably everybody.
Yeah, they're like, this person's being crazy. Can we have a move into the crazy house in town? Mm-hmm. The crazy house in town.
Really nice art in here. I always really like Leonardo Marcello Grassi's stuff, and this is pretty gorgeous. I do think this took a little while to get around to the concept, but where it ends up, I thought was very neat and terrifying and spooky, so I'm very much looking forward to the second issue of this one.
Same.
Transformers, number 13 from Skybound and Image Comics, written by Daniel Warren Johnson, art by Jason Howard. This is a big issue that focuses on Starscream and his origin back on Cybertron. So big stuff going down there. I'm a little bummed out that Pete isn't here, so he can talk about what's so cool about this book. But Justin, what do you think?
I like seeing the young Transformers. Their metal's a little shinier. They have the rest of their creaky little joints haven't gotten them down like us, you know?
Yeah. Oh, was that your only opinion on it? Okay.
No, that's just, I will say, I mean, that's I really did setup. Like that.
Yeah.
But I think in this, this comic has been hyper emotional. So this feels like a little bit of a pullback and reset into a new area before we bring back that emotionality and really set up the villains here.
Really? Interesting. I thought the opposite because I've been missing some of the emotionality in the last couple of issues as we've had a bunch of machines banging up against each other and shooting each other and stuff. This one, focusing in on Starscream, giving him friends, giving him a reason to hate Optimus Prime, I thought was really well done. There's a nice little twist that I won't spoil here in terms of his origin that gives it an emotional connection to those friends as well, which felt very classic Daniel Warren Johnson. So I like this quite a bit. I'll also mention as a side note, I watched the 2007 Transformers movie with my son, and it is weird. Maybe this is just Transformers stuff, but it is weird the amount of plot points from the 2007 Transformers that they use for the Energon universe. Like, specifically, Megatron has been taken out of commission and is being held captive by the U.S. government in that movie, same as he has been in the Energon universe, not the U.S. government, but he's sort of like taken off the board for a while. And they have been using his body to create all the technology for the entire world for decades at this point, same as what they've been doing with the Energon and the Energon universe. So there you go.
Are you saying it's weird that this comic book crossover and big new plan took inspiration from one of the biggest movies in movie franchises of all time?
All I'm saying is this title's bringing the Bayhem.
Oh, good. Bayhem.
Bayhem. Nice. That's, you know, from Michael Bay.
Yeah, I love that. I think we should say that more often. There's not as much Bayhem as there used to be, you know?
There isn't. I heard he's going to bring the Bayhem again with Will Smith. They're talking about doing a movie together. Bad Boys reunion. Uh-oh, Bad Boys alert.
We just had a Bad Boys reunion, like, last year.
Uh-oh, here they come.
They're already here. They're here right now.
What you going to do? What you going to do? No,
they're around. Alex, we've not missed the Bad Boys. They're around.
Woo, woo, woo.
This message comes from BetterHelp. Can you think of a time when you didn't feel like you could be yourself, like you were hiding behind a mask? BetterHelp Online Therapy is convenient, flexible, and can help you learn to be your authentic self so you can stop hiding. Because masks should be for Halloween fun, not for your emotions. Take off the mask with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com.
The Ultimates, number 5 from Marvel, written by Dennis Capp, art by Juan Fregeri. After an issue focusing on Doom, we are back to the recruiting process. And here we find out that presumably Clint Barton Hawkeye was like, no thanks to the whole Ultimates thing. Did the classic throw the costume in the garbage can deal. And it got picked up by somebody of indigenous descent, who Tony Stark immediately pegs as a probable villain. Captain America approaches him, and they have a little bit of a fight, and then a little bit of a team-up. Another fantastic issue of this book, despite the glib way that I just described it, because what it's really diving into is how the U.S. government targets people of indigenous descent and immediately pinpoints them as, oh, you're the enemy, you're the bad guy, you shouldn't have these weapons, you shouldn't be in the power position. And that's what Captain America is exploring and playing with this new character. I thought this was phenomenal.
Yeah, it was great. And it put both of these characters in a position to be right. Like the superheroes fighting is such a gimmick and such a trope in comics. But I think Dennis does a great job of really earning it here and walking us into it in a really smart way where we think we're with Cap, then we think we're with Hawkeye, and then it turns out that they both understand where each other are coming from in a really smart way. And the art by Juan Figuera is excellent, just really great, echoing sort of Ultimates artist's art from the past in a really smart way while still bringing us great action. Captain America does so many great little flips in this.
He does, and I'll give a specific shout out to two back-to-back full-page spreads in here. Spoiler, but it's the two of them fighting together against this army of crossbones, and then the next page is all of the crossbones are down and they're standing in the middle, and it's just same positioning and everything for the most part, but little changes here and there. Very, very cool. Great little page flip, double page spread type thing. Awesome book.
Great cliffhanger for next issue as well. I've been loving this series. Can't wait for more.
Crocodile Black, number 5 for Boom Studios, written by Philip Kennedy Johnson, art by Somm. This is the final issue of the series about a disturbed young boy who is going on a murderous rampage, and it only gets worse this issue. You know, what were we talking about? Oh, Joker 2. You were using the word bleak a lot. That was exactly the word that came to mind reading this. This is a bleak, sad comic book series that is excellently done with some really stunning dreamlike hallucinatory art by Somm, but great, great series.
And I would even say beyond just being bleak, where it's like a story where it's hard to find hope in it, this comic actually makes bleakness a superpower almost. It makes bleakness sort of the way our protagonist gets out of the problematic situation he's in. I just think, and so it's a dark tale, but it's such great comic book storytelling here. It's the synergy of the art along with the story is so fun, and it's something that can only be done in comics. It was my big, reading this issue specifically, the way our main character confronts these gangsters who he was working for, and then were trying to kill him. And then I want to say like 3-page series at the end where he sort of folds himself up and puts himself into the position that we leave him with, I thought was awesome.
Yeah, this is great. If you miss this, definitely go back, pick up the single issues or pick it up when it comes to trade. It was one of my favorite things, I think, that Philip Kennedy Johnson has done. Just a really phenomenal series from front to back and very gut-wrenching and sad at the same time. Batman Full Moon, number 1 from DC Comics, written by Rodney Barnes, art by Stefan Subic. You could probably figure this out from the title, but it's Batman versus werewolves.
He's investigating the surface of the moon through a telescope.
Yeah, mostly. It's Batman sticking his butt out of the Batmobile and just mooning everybody as it goes by.
Oh, man, the Riddler's so pissed. Oh, he hates the moon.
What has 2 cheeks and, oh, God, I don't know.
And 1 hole.
What did you think about this?
You know, there's a lot of stories like this in the Batman canon where Batman encounters some sort of supernatural experience. This one, though, I thought was really well done in that it was rooted really in, like, let's have some fun with the Batman Bruce character first, where we get him dating Zatanna, which I loved that.
Yeah.
And in a way where he sort of, it had a lot of like Spider-Man Mary Jane energy for the first half of the book, where they're having a cell phone conversation on the phone and she's like, where are you? We're not supposed to be on a date. And he's like, ah, sorry, I'm at the pier, I'm a henchman or whatever. And like, it's such a nice, good Bruce being Batman story that, Alex, you've made fun of me before, but I'm always craving, just like Batman, the animated series.
Well, I was going to say very specifically, I don't think they did that there, but it gave me like Justice League Unlimited vibes a little bit. when Batman would, was it a romance with Wonder Woman?
Yes.
Yeah, like a little bit of that being like, we're both very busy. What do we do here? I like that. I don't know what was going on with Zatanna's outfit when there was...
Well, I had the same thought, and this is like, I was like, I don't know if this is a take I need to have, but she's like, mm-hmm. I had a special outfit for you, and the outfit is like, just like some like sick torn up jeans and stuff.
She
and
I looks like Shania Twain.
Yeah. And so I was like, oh, okay. I didn't know that's her take. But I will say for someone that wears, you know, a sort of tuxedo her whole mm-hmm. crime fighting career, maybe she's like, yeah, I have a new outfit.
Yeah.
It's not that. It's not formal I guess magician.
So. I did like to get into a spoiler here, but I did like Mad Bat fighting a werewolf. That's pretty fun with Batman caught in the middle. Always like Stefan Subic's art as well. So good start.
Yes. Great package. Really fun stuff. And then when John Constantine shows up, it's mm-hmm. also very fun.
But his face is weird. I'm just going to throw that out there. The way Stephen Subic draws John Constantine, a little weird. Even though
he doesn't have to be always the same. He could be a little different.
He has to always be the same.
He doesn't have to be like a
except when he's Keanu. He's allowed to be the same except also Keanu. Those are...
See, I think it's weirder when he's Keanu. I think that's much weirder.
Actually, I was trying to say something, but you're 100% right. Exceptional X-Men number 2 from Marvel, written by Eve L. Ewing, art by Carmen Carnero. Kitty Pryde is just trying to have a normal life in Chicago, working at her bar, going out on a date, and it keeps not working out because she keeps running into young mutants who need her help. This issue, she meets two of them, one of them who has phasing powers who are similar but different from hers, and another one who does something, not 100% sure yet. Seems like maybe he's a little chameleon-like or something like that.
There seems to be a lot of phasing / psionic, like everyone's powers are right next door to each other.
Yeah, exactly. And in the meantime, Emma Frost just won't stay out of her head. I love this, and I think this really drove home for me what I want from an X-Men book. Is I want the soap opera. I want the like daily life of trying to balance everything in a world that hates and fears them. And I think this is nailing it. Like Uncanny X-Men is doing a lot of that work as well. There's one of the other From the Ashes titles that I think is doing it well, but like I would put Uncanny X-Men and Exceptional X-Men like on the same tier in terms of like, we're a soap opera. We have all these relationships. That's our main thing. Also, there's some sort of horrible villain or superpowers or whatever else is going on.
Yeah, I mean, the best X-Men runs are soap operas. And I think that's what we want. And the Krakoa era was very much not that. So it makes sense that we're getting sort of a lot of different styles of soap opera. But I would go one step further and say we are having a lot of like, oh, who's the Professor X of this comic? Every mm-hmm. X-Men title is having a new idea of Professor X. We have Cyclops, who's like all aggressive Professor X. Forge, who's like just all like brain, like I trust me, I have a plan Professor X. Rogue is like all heart Professor X. And in Exceptional X-Men, we have Kitty being very much reluctant Professor X, who's like, hey, can I just live? And she keeps being confronted with young mutants who are like, you teach me? And she's like, I'm a bartender. I can teach you how to make a Manhattan, maybe. But I think this tone is really fun. I think Kitty has changed so much. We get a nice reflection of that in the back.
Oh, that flashback sequence.
I knew you were going to love that.
I love that. I couldn't believe Carmen Carnero so successfully aping, it was John Byrne, right? Like John Byrne style.
Yeah. And
back might have been Alan Davis. Maybe it was Alan
Davis.
That's right.
I don't want to say for sure, but it's definitely much that sort of very classic Claremont era illustration style. And we get a flashback there that doesn't make Kitty do the right thing, but you can tell she's going to. And I love that vibe for her and this comic. My only quibble is she's working at a bartender job. She's like, I'm off in 15 minutes. The bar's packed. Mm-hmm. And she walks out on her coworker when the bar's packed. It's fucked up. You stay and you help out.
She's done. She's got a midday date.
You know, you stay for a little bit until the rush has calmed down.
She missed the first date. She wants to make the second date with what's this girl's name? Nita or whatever? She seems nice.
get a just a pint in every Cubs fan's hand, and then you can leave. You can't leave your bartender that under the gun and just go. You can be 10 minutes
later. I assume somebody else came in and took over.
Not mentioned. And she seems a little bit like cavalier about her ability to walk out. It's not okay. It's not like you're punching out for your job at Supercuts. Like, being your bartender, oh, there's an understanding.
Wow, shots fired at Supercuts. My God.
Brah, Supercuts suck it. I've always said that.
Geiger, number 7 from Image Comics and Ghost Machine, written by Jeff Johns, art by Paul Pelletier, stepping in this issue as guest artist. We're continuing to follow Geiger in Journey Across America, ostensibly to get a cure, though I have a feeling that won't happen. Meanwhile, yeah, I know, right? Meanwhile, there are new villains on their heels. They meet some kids that they've got to help out. I really feel like this title has hit its stride in the past couple of issues. You know, it's hitting a lot of the same things every time, but to the same point, I was struck that, like, they're making every issue accessible to a new reader. Like, you could pick up this issue of Geiger and be like, oh, that's who Geiger is. This is who this other guy is. Now I'm going with the story.
Well, I think that is a thing in comics, but my thing is, like, I feel like every issue of this comic since it started has been issue zero. And we get that again here, where, like, we get, like, a little, like, intro, like, in the wasteland, it's hard to be anything, but the glowing man fights for all of us. I'm like, I know. I know this. I know all of this so hard. And I think the last issue, which focused on the two-headed dog, and we get the zebra. Here's the zoo issue, which I thought was really cool. We're back into sort of resetting, and I just want a new flavor. I want progression with these characters, or just something. Geiger only ever says either nothing or just a gruff response like he deserved to die. And I'm just like, okay. So I'm ready to move it forward.
I think Paul Pelletier's art is a really good compliment for this book. Yes. His pencils were great here throughout. I really liked what he did with this world, particularly whatever the Knight Squire guy is. I thought there was a good amount of pathos in the way that he depicted them. So I thought that was
the cool. Guy that dies, the gold.
No, beard. Not him. The squire who is half scarred face palling around.
Oh, with Geiger's. Geiger's buddy.
Geiger Squigers.
Yeah, his squiggers, Junior, the less glowing man.
Yes.
I agree, like, especially since this post-apocalypse has, like, king, queen, knight vibes to it. Paul Pelletier is great for that.
Speaking of kings, queens, and knights, let's move over to Minor Arcana, number 2 for Boom Studios by Jeff Lemire. At the end of the last issue, our very cranky character ended up in a weird vision while she was trying to tell the fortune of a woman. It turns out this is some sort of purgatory afterlife where she meets the man she was married to, the one she's telling the fortune of, married to, who has been waiting for her. I thought this was really neat and an interesting view of the afterlife up until the point, and I do want to spoil this because I think this was our same complaint with the first issue. As soon as she comes out of that purgatory, the lady's like, what did you see? And she's like, nothing. Get out of here. Wait, leave me alone. And I was trying to imagine any world beyond a story that I'm telling where this person has to slowly progress through this, where a person came back from purgatory and was like, nothing, I'm not saying anything about this. That seemed like a crazy movie.
Oh, I met your true love who's waiting for you in, like, a cool, like, romantic way. I'm not telling you about that. Like, I was like, why are you so nasty? Yeah.
It's just a step too far in terms of, like, delaying it. Maybe there's a reason for it that we're going to get, but I don't know. That turn did not work for me.
Well, I think it just made it. It is a bridge too far for a character to be someone we can ride with. I was like, "That's." I know you have your own issues with clearly like having this ability to transgress the planes of reality or whatever you want to call it. But the fact that you can't tell this lady that her husband, and we learn in over the course of this issue that she's the main character's mom's only customer because she comes constantly to try to connect with her partner in the afterlife. I'm like, yo, say one thing about the meeting Gene mm-hmm. in the afterlife. So like, that's all to say, I like this book. I think the story's interesting. The characters are good, but I want the turn where she's going to be a little bit of a better person now, because it's such a sour taste when she's so nasty.
She nasty. Action Comics 1070 from DC Comics, written by Mark Waid and Mariko Tamaki, art by Clayton Henry and Skylar Patridge. We're kicking off a weekly run on Action Comics, which is great. That takes me back to my Superman reading of my youth. And here we're getting a twisted take on the Phantom Zone as they're exploring the evolution of that with some really horrific visuals from Clayton Henry. And then the backup story, there's a eerie, mysterious story, is the way I'd put it, from Mariko Tamaki and Skylar Patridge about Supergirl leaving Earth. Loved Skylar Patridge's art in that one in particular. It's so sparse throughout and haunting. I don't know exactly what's going on or where we're going with that one, but I'm very intrigued.
Well, it's not at all the shiny art we're used to from the Super Family, and I think it really works. It reminds me of the Tom King Supergirl story in mm-hmm. a nice way. Like, it has sort of a little bit more of that storybook, a little sort of like you're turning the old pages of a book, which I think is great because it does feel like it's a little bit in that realm, except more sci-fi than fantasy. And then the front story, I think, is also great. Like, Mark Waid getting us into exploring the Phantom Zone in a way I think we don't learn a lot about it in this, but I think we're going to see it in a new light going forward. It reminded me of the Speed Force a little bit, and I think Mark Waid is maybe going to reinvent what the Phantom Zone is.
Star Wars Ewoks, number one for Marvel, written by Steve Orlando, art by Alvaro Lopez and Laura Braga. We are picking up in the same era as the, what is it called, Rise of the Resistance or Battle of Jakku, the crossover thing that we were
post-Jedi.
Talking about. Yes, a real post-Jedi world back on Endor, the forest moon of Endor. I don't know why I
blanked. What are you reading off of a script?
I don't know, man. These answers. These small fuzzballs are fighting.
So Jedi are knights of the force.
This is my first interaction with this franchise, and I don't really get it. Anyway, we're getting a bunch of stuff, including Admiral Abelhard. That part I legitimately
That makes don't sense that you don't know what that is, because he's brand new.
Yes, he's our brand new bad guy for this era. And what happens to the Ewoks afterwards? What happens to Wicket afterwards as well? That's what we're getting a little bit of here. What'd you think, Justin?
We start with the Ewoks. I mean, this Admiral Abelhard, across the other Star Wars books we've been talking about, is being set up as, like, the biggest bad of all. Everyone's scared of him. Like, back in the original Star Wars franchise, the other Imperial guys sort of talk shit about Darth Vader. Like, yeah, he sucks a little bit every now and again, but they're scared of him. This guy, everyone's just purely scared of. Mm-hmm. But he's just, like, a guy with cool hair. So, like,
that's what I was going
to
say.
We need to see him do something badass.
My two notes about Admiral Abelhard, I like the idea of a post-death of the Emperor general is like, nope, not letting go of the Empire. Great idea. Love that. Very into that. I'm just a dude who's hanging out in Brooklyn on Tuesday evening drinking a coffee or something like that vibe, the way that he looks, is like not scary at all. He needs to look way scarier.
Yeah, he has, like, wicked epaulets, and I'm like, yeah, what? What are you?
The second note that I would have is Admiral Abelhard, not a scary name.
What do you want? Well, here's the
thing. I don't know. It sounds like he's a cobbler in some sort of fairy tale or something like that.
But what are they pushing against? We have Darth Vader. Every other villain in the Star Wars universe is named, like, Duke Nasty. It's like, it makes sense why his name's a little bit different than that.
Yeah, I guess they're trying to do it with their, like, Abelhard, I guess. Maybe that was the idea there, but at the same time, it's like
Cain and Abel.
Yeah.
Think about it.
he's just like, he's a poor cobbler who has sent his only daughter on a mission to beg the king for a morsel of food. And that's a great origin.
If he just wanted to make shoes, and instead he's had to run this. But I mean, this is rooted. Most of the story here is focused on the Ewoks. We get like a lot of like Wicket trying to like figure out what his life is now, where he's like, I want to fight the bad guys all the time. They're like, that's not happening again.
Yeah. Also, here's a snake that has a tongue that looks like Ewoks or something like that.
That was weird. And I also like the second the non-Abelhard villain who crash lands on Endor is like, well, the ship's fucked up, guys. I'm like, what are you? It has like comedy elements to it, yeah. But I'm like, none of it is played that way.
Mm-hmm.
Like they literally crash and they have to, him and like a band of like random killers show up to like slaughter the Ewoks.
Yeah. We also meet the Batman of Ewoks, which I thought was a kind of an interesting move as well.
Also weird. And they look like Grinches from Dr. Seuss. I was like, who are you guys? And why don't I know? Is this a pre-existing
thing? No. There was the race of Grinches. And then there was also the Batman of Ewoks, who's like the Red Ghost or something like that, who shows up. So lots going on in this book.
Lots. If you want to meet the Batman of Ewoks, this is the book for you.
If you want to meet the Ewok of Batmans, check out Absolute Batman. Yeah. Public Domain number 9 from Image Comics by Chip Zdarsky. In this issue, it's time for, I'm going to read the title here, San Diego Comic Expo. That's what they're calling it in the book.
Twist.
As both of the companies we've been following, the big Marvel-esque company, as well as our upstart company, are planning on introducing their versions of the Domain, the superhero at the center here, at the con at the same time. Another great issue of this book, so funny and heartfelt, and man, the thing that happens at the end, I did not see coming. I felt like I should have seen coming, and it is such a great twist.
I said this a little bit on the live show in that when we heard that this was what this issue was about, I was like, it feels like it's all been leading up to this. Like so much of comic book creators' year and lives, like Comic-Con is where it all happens. And so to read this issue knowing that it was going to take place at a Comic-Con, it just paid off so hard. Like everything did happen. All the characters were like a slingshot pulled back so hard and fired right into this comic. There's great jokes. There's a super funny, they meet a PR rep who, it works for GYN PR and it stands for Got Your Nose. And there's just a great joke, a walkaway joke, where it's like, well, at least it wasn't GYD. And I was like, yo, that's such a subtle joke that we have to think about to really get. And great. And then the relationship reveals that you're talking about, Alex, at the end, I thought were great. The twists and turns. This series just, it pops so hard in this issue. So you got to read all of them, but this is the one where it really happens.
I Heart Skull Crusher, number 6 from Boom Studios, written by Josie Campbell, art by Alessia Zono. This takes place in a post-apocalyptic world where the most popular game is called Screaming Painball. We're following a character named Trini, I believe, who wants to be the absolute best. This was meant to be a mini-series, but it was so popular they're continuing it. Spoiler for the first part of the miniseries, but Trini led her team to win Screaming Painball, and as a reward slash punishment, they were all split up. So now we're seeing what the ramifications of that are. I love this book. This is such a earnest central character pushing through this terrible Mad Max world to find a germ of hope and friendship in the middle there. Great stuff. Just if you're wondering, even with the Death Games, it's still an all-ages title, and it absolutely works as such. Very, very fun.
When we first started reading this, I was like it went so hard in those first few issues where our Trini Wastelander, our main character, was just like, I'm going to be the best. And it felt like, oh, this is going to be very hard. But classic protagonist, the basic Rocky, any sort of sports analogy movie, and they just nail it so hard in this, and the twist in this next iteration of it are so smart, and you just ride so hard for these characters. Mm-hmm. And you know that it's going to be a battle that she will keep winning, mm-hmm. but the ride is so worth it.
It's also, I would recommend it, and this is really based on one joke in the book that like snapped it in place for me. If you're a fan of not necessarily Avatar, but if you're a fan of Korra in particular, you will
that's a great
love
call.
This book.
That's a very specific slot.
Yeah, well, they played into. Oh my God, what was the name of the game that they played in Korra? I'm totally glad you got it right now.
Yes, same. I can't think of it, but it what you're pointing out is the world building they did, and this book does the same thing.
But it also has a very similar sense of humor. Like, there's one running joke about one of the characters on Trudy's team is a bear, and people are like, oh, that's a man bear, and everybody's like, no, it's just a bear. And we get to see it briefly in this issue just ripping apart the team that it was put on. Very funny, very dark joke, but it just reminds me of that classic Avatar joke where they meet a bear, and they're like, oh, so what do you mean, like a platypus bear? And they're like, nope, just a bear. That's it.
Just a bear.
Just a bear.
I love that. I love that.
Yeah. Anyway.
Call out. Rug
great stuff. Check out. I really love this. I heart Skull Crusher. Batman and Robin, number 14 from DC Comics, written by Philip Kennedy Johnson, art by Javi Fernandez. This is kicking off the new all-in run. And we are looping back to Damian Wayne's origin in this issue in a big way that looks like it might change and tweak a bunch of stuff, which I thought was neat. Much more serious take, I thought, on Batman and Robin than we were getting from, say, Joshua Williamson on the title. But good. Good, intense, good art.
But good.
What'd you think? But good.
This issue has gotten a lot of hype online, I think, from other comic creators that I've seen. I think Scott Snyder was hyping this up a bunch. So shouts to that if you like his opinion on it. But for ours...
Well,
like,
he's not on this show.
That's right. Unless he is, have him step out. He's in my living room. But I do think this does refresh the relationship here and bring Bruce and Damian a little bit more to the forefront. Include as well as Batman and Robin, which I think is nice and really sets just the fact that Bruce so much in this issue is like, and this is my son, Damian. I'm like, oh, this is nice to have it be there rather than the more formal relationship that they have as crime fighters, I thought was the real refreshing note. And the fact that that's going to dovetail into more Damian exploration, I think is a nice relationship and emotional way to start this new run.
Totally agreed. Next up, The Amazing Spider-Man, number 59 from Marvel, written by Zeb Wells, art by John Romita Jr. As you can probably tell from the cover, we are picking up exactly where we left off in the last issue with Tombstone and Spider-Man bashing each other to bits all over New York City as Tombstone tries to kill his own daughter, leading to a emotional revelation at the end of this issue. This is a very brutal fight, as promised. So instead of what I said about Blade, kudos to Marvel here on delivering what they promised. This should have been a Red Band book, honestly.
Wow. Man, you really live and die by the band on the comic.
Yeah. Give me a band.
Guy loves to know the band. I think this has been some of Zeb Wells, the best issues of Zeb Wells' run, these last couple. Because it's putting all of the background buildup of the mob stuff, the gang war stuff, and putting Spider-Man in a spot to be like, I'm just being a hero here. Like, he cares about these people a little. He knows them. But, like, he's really – there's a great moment that it builds to where he's like, I'm not doing this for justice. I'm doing this for you. I'm not saving her, your daughter, that you're trying to kill over the course of these last two issues. I'm here saving you. And I thought it was really just beautifully done to have – it's such a Spider-Man answer in that moment, and to have it come after just, like, 18 brutal pages of just punching and smashing. It's just such a New York issue as well. They're in the subway. They're like, like coming out of a building. Everyone's getting pushed around where rats mm-hmm. poop. Like, it's very, like, it's very Spider-Man.
There was one thing that actually really tested me as a New Yorker, because they very clearly label a side of the subway as it's the Canal Street stop and you can exit at Avenue of the Americas. And I was like, is it Avenue of Americas all the way down there at Canal Street? Because I always feel like it stops at like 14th Street.
Yeah.
But I think it is. Like, I actually spent 10 minutes searching it up, and technically that is correct. But I don't know.
What train line? It's not the N train.
I think, I searched through a ton of pictures. I believe at the ACE stop on Canal Street, it is Avenue of the Americas.
That's accurate.
I think so.
I thought you were saying the
N train. It totally threw me for whatever reason, because I was like, what? What are we talking about here? That doesn't make sense.
But I don't know. They are being a little bit, it does say special. It's an S train, technically.
It's an S train? No.
It's what it says here. It says special. Like, it's S special there. Mm-hmm. See?
Oh,
like, this is, it's not 100% accurate.
Should we try for no prize here? I think what happened was that in the Marvel Universe, Avenue of the Americas goes further south in Manhattan than it does in the real world.
I would argue that for a separate no prize, that there's a special S train that runs only when superheroes are fighting supervillains in the subway.
I think what they do is they change the letter to whatever the superhero is. So they're like, oh, it's Spidey. Flip to S. Yeah. There's Wolverine now it's the W train.
Yeah. You don't want to be on the G train, the Galactus train. That's a real fucked up ride.
Oh, he ate. Scarlet, number 5 from Skybound Image Comics, written by Kelly Thompson, art by Marco Ferrari. This is the final issue of this series, as Scarlet, Storm Shadow, and Jinx all try to escape from the building with this mystical sword, leading to a new status quo for the Energon universe. I'll reiterate my same thing that I said for the last issue. Kelly Thompson knows how to write a great spy caper. This is a fun, good conclusion to it. I am intrigued to see what's going to happen going forward with these characters. I have no clue what that sword is, and I feel like it should be a bigger deal than it is. And everybody keeps being like, whoa, that sword's bad.
It's not like it's a sword we know about in our regular lives. Only in the comic is it important.
Right. If Pete was here, because he did the last time, he's like, what? What are you talking about? It's the blah, blah, blah sword.
But here's the thing. Pete's a huge fan of this guy named Storm Shadow. But, like, what is Storm Shadow at its core? It's just a cloud. It's a cloud cover. His name should be Cloud Cover.
Yeah.
Not Storm Shadow.
Yeah, should be Cloudy with the Chance of Meatballs at best.
That feels like him. So, like, he can hold up whatever shiny sword he wants. He's just Cloudy with a light chance of meatballs.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed this. I thought the art was also fantastic by Marco Ferrara. And it's really great, but it did end abruptly, I thought. Mm-hmm. I wanted this to go another issue. I feel like we lost Scarlet, especially in this issue, and it became about Storm Shadow and the sword, and I was really sort of connected with Scarlet, especially mm-hmm. as we built up over the course of the series.
So here, I'm going to just mention the spoiler for the end here. So if anybody doesn't want to know, please do turn away. But at the end of the issue, Scarlet is back with the Arishikage clan. Is that what it is? The ninjas.
Arishikage.
Yeah, sure. The ninjas clan, which explains why she is not in the G.I. Joe series that's coming out from Joshua Williamson, at least on the cover of the first issue or anything like that, which was certainly a question because she's kind of like a mainstay of G.I. Joe. But I think what they are doing here, this is just me pure speculation, but we've already developed Cobra in the background. They've been showing up everywhere. So now they're a full-fledged organization, as we've seen over various miniseries. G.I. Joe is just kicking off when we get into G.I. Joe number 1. So I think what we're doing is we're throwing a third faction in there.
Yeah.
That's not just G.I. Joe versus Cobra. You've also got the Arishikage clan in the middle there, who now has this powered up sword and could really mess things up at the same time. So, which, if that's the way they're going and that's the idea there, I do think that's interesting because it makes it instantly a much more complex universe than usual with G.I. Joe stuff.
Well, and I think, yeah, they're just muddying the waters a bit to create a more disparate battle eventually down the road. Because, you know, Cobra Commander's in his own place, Destro's in his own place. No doubt Snowjob is sort of working on his own thing. Mm-hmm. Like, everybody's doing their... Teacup is going to do his
phone charger. Thing. Phone charger.
Yeah, phone charger's
I got love a whole him. Other... He was my favorite back in the day.
He's good, especially like what you were talking about earlier, not having a phone charger at the party. Like, mm-hmm. I was always calling the phone charger.
Ah, good. I love the...
He has, instead of Wolverine, he's like Wolverine, except he doesn't pop claws. He pops different chargers. Like, your Android.
You feel it, Android punk?
I'm the best, sir, at what I do, and what I do is charge your device.
What do you got? USB-C? All right. Duck and Cover, number 2 from Dark Horse Comics, written by Scott Snyder, art by Raphael Albuquerque. This is reprinting the Comixology book that they did together, where a bunch of kids ducked and covered under their desks. Turns out it was a alien invasion, not nuclear bombs. And the neat thing that they're doing, to get back to the structure discussion we were having, maybe you're going to bring this up here, is that every issue is based on a different genre of movie that you would see at a drive-in, which I didn't realize in the first issue, but they hit pretty hard here, and it seems like they're going to hit hard in the last issue as well. I thought that was very cool.
Yeah, and it really, like, takes... Like, if you were to, at the end of this issue, you walk away with, like, so... The desks that they were duck and covering were specifically designed with this alien metal or alien infused metal that protected just children from this their attack. I was like, oh, this is a very like B sci-fi movie from the 50s premise. So, and like when I was reading, I was like, oh, that's sort of off. But then I was like, oh, but it's intentionally off. Mm-hmm. Because I think that's sort of the point of the book, that like they're both commenting on genre storytelling while also doing an extremely genre story. And that's fun, and it makes sense that it's exactly what Scott and Raphael wanted to get back to after American Vampires, which sort of was in that same nostalgia Americana, taking old genres and just smashing them together for a story. It feels like a great follow-up to that.
Totally agree. Fantastic Four, number 26 from Marvel, written by Ryan North, art by Ivan Fiorelli. It was their Halloween issue as Reed and Johnny dig up their basement, discover a well of ghosts, and have to shut it down. This is, I say this complimentary, one of the goofiest issues I've ever read of Fantastic Four in my entire life. I loved it, to the point that, like, Sue shows up at the edge. We're like, what are you guys doing? This is the craziest story I've ever heard. Where every other issue of this comic so far, like, there's been fun and funny stuff, but it's mostly like, here's a science concept that I want to explore and let's go into it. This is literally just, it sounds like a crazy Shaggy Dog story. So much fun.
Well, but I will say they do a good job. First off, this cover is the least Fantastic Four cover of all time. But it's great. It's just that Reed and Johnny drowning in a bunch of blood pouring out of a skull. I was like, intriguing. I'm in. But the story unfolds, and you're with them. They're doing a bunch of dumb stuff, but it feels like the natural reaction in a very like horror movie way. And then when Sue and Ben show up, they're like, "What the fuck are you guys doing? You shouldn't have done any of this." And they're in, like, dumb costumes, but they're still like, you guys are the dumb ones.
Yeah.
You did all this dumb stuff.
Ben's dress is Gandalf. Reed's like, it's pretty funny.
It's very funny. And Reed's like, I'm not dumb. And she's like, you are. And Johnny's like, we are. We'll fix the house. They're like teenagers. And that's the amazing flexibility, shouts to Mr. Fantastic, of this book. It can stretch into any corner, follow any genre line. Ryan North... This continues to be the most consistently satisfying comic on the stands.
One thing I want to say just before we turn away is I've seen people posting about this online, so maybe I was a little more hyper aware of it, but Ryan North and Ivan Fiorelli have been really pushing Reed's powers in some gross ways. And yes, this issue, he splits his face. Yeah. Can he do that? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, he's like, he's just Play-Doh at this point. He's,
I guess.
Anything your kids can do with Play-Doh, he can do.
I guess.
He's Goop.
DC versus Vampires, World War V, number 3 from DC Comics, written by Matthew Rosenberg and Tyler Boss, art by Otto Schmidt and Tyler Boss. So the front story, we're getting the World War V of the title as a bunch of different things are going on. Damian Wayne is fighting back against the rest of his vampire kind. Meanwhile, Mr. Miracle, who is also a vampire, is trying to keep his child safe. And if you ever wondered about the physical dimensions of Mr. Miracle and Big Barda having sex, I have great news for you about this issue.
Great book. Loved it. I only read those two pages over and over again, so you have to fill in the rest.
I couldn't believe that happened in this book. I mean, it's fine. I don't know, I will say that problem. What?
It was a great scene.
It was the best scene. I was just like, oh, I've never actually thought about that, but now I will never stop thinking about that, I guess.
It is. I mean, I don't know if they're in the Tom King book. I don't think they were portrayed as quite this different in size.
Right. But he's a skinny little guy.
And she's famously big. Mm-hmm. It's in her name.
That's part of her name.
A lot of Alfred love in this comic from first story all the way into backstory. So shouts to that, I will say. And this comic is, Matt Rosenberg has such an understanding of so many corners of the DC universe, brings in a lot of characters, Orphan Maker here in a fun way, and is able to make sense of a story about vampire factions where the humans are really on the periphery. Like, so much of this is about different vampires being mad at each other. It's still fun, still engaging, and still looking forward to what happens.
X-Force, number 4 from Marvel, written by Jeffrey Thorne, art by Marcus Toe. In this issue, the team is continuing to deal with Nuklo, and now they end up in Man-Thing Swamp, battling him there. What'd you think about this?
I mean, this book, I don't know...
I've lost the track. That's why I kicked it over to you.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
I think it had a couple of very strong opening issues, or a couple, literal, two very strong issues. And then this Nuklo thing coming in the middle over now, 3 issues is, I guess, we're heading into.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure what we're doing anymore.
Well, you know what it is? It feels like the main X-Men title is should be X-Force. Mm-hmm. And this title should be Exiles. Mm. This should be... It feels like this team of mutants is like always at sea, just popping up in a different place. They're being led by a device on Forge's... a little orb that Forge is holding onto. Like, this feels very Exiles. And when you come at it from an Exiles point of view, it makes sense how chaotic it is. And how it's like, oh, did everyone... Sage kicks off the book with like, oh, did everyone die? I guess everyone didn't die. Okay, that's good. Let's fight. And there's the mystery character of Tank. We seem to have some multiversality here that we're jumping into. So, like, I think if they just changed the letters after the X in this title, it would make a little bit more sense. But I do like it. It's mm-hmm. it's fun, and it's written well. I like the different voices here. It's just it's pointed in the wrong direction.
Last but definitely not least, Dracula, a storybook portfolio from Image Comics by J.H. Williams III. Per the title, this is J.H. Williams III retelling the story of Dracula as a picture book, an oversized picture book. On one side, you got the J.H. Williams III art illustrating it. On the other side, a simplified version of the Dracula story through text pages. This is stunning and gorgeous, a complete piece of artwork from front to back. I mean, you wouldn't expect anything less from J.H. Williams III, who delivers amazing work every time out of the gate. But I was really This was not what I was expecting, even from the title, but it's great. This deserves a place on everybody's shelf.
Well, and even beyond, like, for it to be, like, positioned as, like, oh, just a retelling of Dracula, like, it's its own story. Like, mm-hmm. I wouldn't, if someone was like, tell me about Dracula, I wouldn't tell this specific story. Like, it's very nuanced. There's a ton of characters that are positioned in different ways. There's a love affair and different things that really come to bear over the course of it that aren't in every Dracula myth. So I do think it's really cool. It's a very much a different, it's not a comic. I think it really is a storybook as opposed to what we would expect from a regular comic.
It's great stuff. Definitely pick it up. And that is it for the stack. If you'd like to support the show and all the shows we do, patreon.com/comicbookclub. Also, we do a live show every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. to Facebook and YouTube. Come hang out. We would love to chat with you about comic books. Apple, Spotify, Android, or the app of your choice to subscribe, listen, and follow the show at Comic Book Live on Twitter/X, comicbookclublive.com for this podcast and many more. Until next time, we'll see you at the Comic Book Club. Don't.